Welcome back to the Combat Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Peacock, 4-3 black belt in Taekwondo and a martial arts skill training specialist. If you're new to the show, please sign up to the Combat Learning newsletter at combatlearning.com/newsletter. I'll send you cheat sheets on how to transform your drills into maximum skill building games and get you up to speed on the science of motor skill learning for martial arts. Plus, you'll never miss a show. Go to combatlearning.com/newsletter. To get those resources now. Today, Pedro Sierra returns to the podcast to update us on his program in two parts. In this first installment, we talk about how before understanding ecological dynamics, Sierra MMA had lackluster results in competition. Since implementing the constraints-led approach, Sierra MMA now has begun to see much more success. In fact, thanks to his change in training methodology, one of Coach Pedro's students even won an ADCC Open. Pedro has come a long way since we first talked. As this episode unfolds, we discuss some of the problems he ran into and how he solved them. One of them involves round intensity and time constraints and how he solved that problem through a series of experiments and trial and error. We also discuss self-organization and how accounting for it helps us design better sparring games. Finally, this moves into a discussion about understanding what intention and attention are and how they work practically inside the constraints-led approach. If you're excited to jump in, hit the subscribe button and enjoy the show. And if you're listening from YouTube, be sure also to drop a like. All right, welcome back. So for those of the listeners that don't know who you are, didn't listen to the previous episode, can you very quickly reintroduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. My name is Pedro Sierra. I've been doing jiu-jitsu for about 27 years. I've got a black belt in judo, karate, got a couple years of boxing under my belt. I've been doing Muay Thai. I did it for about 15 years. I don't actively practice anymore because I'm a little bit older and things hurt. I don't compete anymore in jiu-jitsu, but I do have a school that does have competitors. We've been in business for about 2.5 years now. And we started Ecological Dynamics about 8 months ago.
Awesome. So one of my friends that trains with you told me that you've had a lot of really great tournament successes recently. So can you go ahead and unpack your competition success you've been experiencing?
Sure. We have not done so great in tournaments since we started our school. We've had individuals who have done well, but as a team, we haven't done that great, to be honest. Mm. This month, the first weekend we had at Grappling Industries, where we had a number of white belts and blue belts that have been training Ecological Dynamics for the last 8 months. Mm. And in nearly every competitor, I think we had 6 or 8, at least placed, if not got a gold medal. Now, we're going to take that with a little bit of grain of salt because white and blue belts, you know, sometimes intensity wins the match. Sometimes the other person isn't very well prepared. But what I was excited about was that the training room activities or the representativeness of our training directly translated or transferred to the performance environment. That made me really, really happy, which Excellent. Just means that what we're doing here is allowing them to use the skill we use every class, and they don't have to change it for the tournament except for the individual movements of their opponent.
Awesome.
We had one competitor compete in the ADCC Open last weekend. Mm. And he took gold in that. I think it was intermediate at 77 kilos. And he finished all five matches with submission.
Excellent. Now, intermediate, is that usually where purple belts camp out?
Yeah. Purple belts are usually in that division.
So pretty tough.
It's not a bad division at all. Not bad at all. And we were pretty happy with the not only the win, But the fact that every match had a submission is really something that we're looking for. Again, what TJ, our competitor, is doing in the training room directly translated to the performance environment. That's as a coach, that's really exciting. And then obviously for our team, that's exciting for them. We want them to be successful and see that what we're doing is allowing them to find that same success on the competition mat.
Yeah, awesome. So how did you use the ecological approach to prepare for these tournaments, or did you? Was it just regular class?
To be honest, it was just regular class. Now, we did some focused training, like for ADCC, you have to understand how turning turtle denies your opponent points.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really the only thing that we did, the only focus that we had, other than making sure that we had some form of wrestling game every single class.
Okay.
For me, ADCC is the focus of our school. And so our training needs to reflect that. The schools that I've been to, for the most part, and that's not all, but for the most part, haven't included takedowns or wrestling in regular class. There's a separate class for that. And I think that's a value. But mm-hmm. I want the majority of our students to be more comfortable hand fighting and finding the single, the double, the body lock, and then the counters to that, the front headlock, as a matter of regular practice. And I think that helped our competitors, especially our white and blue belts, be more comfortable in that environment because they do it every single class.
Right. And just to clarify for listeners, I kind of asked that question weird. What I really meant was if he was doing something special for the tournaments from an ecological perspective, not if he was using ecological approach in every match. I know that there's going to be some, nerd somewhere that's like, oh, he just admitted he didn't use the ecological approach for every class. But no, that's not what I was asking.
I do. I don't think there's any class that I don't use the ecological approach.
Yeah. Cool.
There's no jiu-jitsu class that doesn't have the ecological approach throughout, start to finish.
Awesome. Yeah, it can be done. There's more and more people doing it now.
Yeah. Now, it's not easy. There's some things I struggle with, but we're mm-hmm. making progress in the right direction.
Yes. And it takes, a little bit of courage to make the leap, and you kind of have to get over some limiting beliefs, at first. It's really hard to let go of some of those crutches, and really hard not to slip back into the habits of what I would call overcoaching, and giving too much instruction ahead of time and too much detailed feedback on everything.
Yeah, I set up the game. I let them play it. Now, the one of the things that I do struggle with, since I've taught information processing or explicit instruction for so long, mm-hmm. that I struggle with when they have a hard time not giving them an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really working to be patient and let them learn through the process of failure and success.
Yeah,
that is my goal. I'm not perfect at it yet, but that is the goal.
Absolutely, it is a process. You're not going to be good at it overnight. And the coaching is the same as learning in the sense that you're going to make mistakes at applying the ecological dynamics. And it's going to be a long process of calibrating yourself to where, most of the time you can ask questions or adjust a constraint and help the student to get to a solution, or to at least to productively explore an area where they can start finding a solution.
And that's the part that I'm really trying to be better at. Instead of just giving them an answer, I want to mm-hmm. give a direction that helps them find the answer.
Right. And sometimes Rob Gray says this too, if you hit, that stuff's just not working and the student's just getting more and more frustrated, it's okay to step in and say, hey, have you tried this? Or go ahead and try this, or, something like that is okay, only after the problem has been directly experienced, right?
Yeah.
Most people, they try and teach a technique at the beginning of class in such a way that you are not going to make any of the mistakes. Here's all the details. You've got to get all the details right. And if you do all the details, the technique will work with 95% success rate and you won't make mistakes, which is, of course, not how it works.
We're not finding that at our school.
Yeah, absolutely. So switching gears here, how has your program changed since we first talked, I believe in like January or February? What does your jiu-jitsu program look like now? Is there anything about it that's changed significantly?
Hopefully I'm getting more skilled at communicating the task and the constraints more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm starting to come up and have been coming up with games of my own. In the beginning, I stole a lot of games from other people, from Greg Sauters and from nonlinear, mm-hmm. I think it's nonlinear jiu-jitsu. But I didn't really understand what I was doing. And so mm-hmm. I had to do a little bit more research and find out the concepts that I want them to be able to apply. And that just required a little bit more communication on my part to help them find their way through that. We have reduced the intensity by increasing the time frame. So we started with 3 minutes, which was really high intensity.
Right.
3 minutes is, especially for conditioned athletes, is really not much time at all. So they would do the things that they already knew instead of exploring new options. So yeah. We increased the time to 6 minutes, and then we're going to be 8 minutes here pretty soon. That it really is a noticeable change in the intensity of their action because they know they have time to try and figure out the problem as opposed to frantically look for some type of win.
Right.
Let's see. Those would be the two major changes that we've had. Our conditioning, I think I said it last time, but the conditioning has gone through the roof. We're doing, in the evening we have 90-minute classes and they're working for 80 minutes. So their conditioning without an extra conditioning program is quite good.
Cool. So it sounds like, the intensity was a little bit of a problem. Not having enough time to explore was a problem. And then you solved both of those problems by lengthening the time constraint. And so that gives them a little bit more breathing room and kind of brings the intensity down a bit so that they have to be more judicious with their energy expenditure so that they can explore and have, energy for the next of the round. So I think Greg does, this is not the only correct way to do it. 6 minutes is good. 8 minutes is good. We used to do 8 minutes at one of the places I used to roll out a lot. I think 8 minutes is pretty close to a lot of the match times at some competitions, if I'm not mistaken.
I agree with you.
I think Greg does 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, for all of his rounds and all levels. I might be incorrect about that, but I think he does that. That's only a 2 minute difference, but I know that Scott Seavright does more variability between the different time constraints. He'll do longer ones and then he'll do shorter ones because he kind of wants a little bit more intensity between some of the rounds. But yeah. I'm just basically thinking out loud there so that listeners can understand that there's not just one way to do it. And yeah. when you hear a cool idea from somebody, something's just working for somebody else, you don't have to just copy that and stick it in a template. There's more than, there's more ways to do it, and you should, everything you do, it should do for like a good reason. You should understand the reason behind why you're doing it.
We have a fundamentals class and those rounds are usually just 3 minutes, but oftentimes the people that are in that class are so brand new that their conditioning isn't at all up to par for 6 minutes. Every once in a while, we'll have a guy who comes in brand new, does 3 minutes, and then he goes and throws up, and then he comes back. So, if we can minimize their stress in that beginning period, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Many such cases in jiu-jitsu. Yeah. And new to jiu-jitsu. Are there problems that you still need to solve, things that you're still looking to work through from an ecological practice design?
100%. I just listened to something from Rob Gray on Tuesday. He talks about the theoretical ideas underpinning all of the design practice. Mm-hmm. I had to work through what that meant for me. And mm-hmm. I think I've gotten it, but I don't know. I was going to ask you and maybe a couple other people about designing practice based off of the idea of self-organization and affordances.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we design the games, but the games have to have constraints that lead the students to identify affordances or opportunities for action, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then we have the coordination phase and the adaptation phase. So lower skill student and a higher skill student. That's something mm-hmm. that I've just recently started implementing was a different constraint, different constraints for less skilled than more skilled.
Right.
And that seems to have pretty good results. Sometimes mm-hmm. we have a student that is so far advanced that I'm like, okay, you have to give yourself an additional constraint. Like you only use one arm, do it with your eyes closed. You can't use your right hand or whatever the case may be. So that there's a more win-loss, a more evenly balanced win-loss ratio, as opposed to one person winning and the other person just getting crushed.
Right. Yeah. So when you're thinking in terms of constraints. So the principle from nonlinear pedagogy and the constraints-led approach is constrained to afford, right? That is the principle underlying the thought of putting in constraints for the specific purpose of helping certain affordances to emerge that you then expect your learners to eventually pick up on. And that is far and beyond now a games-based approach, like a teaching games for understanding, because those games are a little bit more general, or those approaches to putting together games are a bit more general. Whereas, the ecological dynamics framework or constraints-led approach to creating practice exercises, which they're games, is more specific because we are actually trying to understand the way the different task constraints, organismic constraints, and environmental constraints. And a part of the environmental constraints is really your practice area, your ring, the shape of the ring, the size of the ring, and the equipment that you use. Understanding how manipulating those various constraints affect behavior during a game, during a practice match. And once you start to understand approximately in a general way, because everyone's an individual, how these start to help to facilitate certain affordances, now you're really advanced, in my opinion. Now you're really understanding how to use the ecological approach to design practice. So you're definitely right about that. I've seen you post the books that you're reading. So you're reading the usual text, the nonlinear pedagogy text, the constraints-led approach text. You mentioned the two-phase learning model, which is the coordination and adaptation phases. There's a larger one that's three steps, but I think that the two-phase model is much easier to understand for people that are new. And it is a lot more practical for designing like a foundations and an all levels class versus trying to put together three separate types of classes. I don't think that works very well.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
So in that same thought line, if I have the coordination phase and the adaptation phase,
mm-hmm.
then I have to focus their intention and attention, right? If I understand right, the intention would be the task or the goal that they're trying to achieve.
Right.
Their attention would be, and this is just what I came up with, the invariance of successful task completion, not the steps that they have to take, but let's take an arm lock for an example. In order to find, to pin, isolate and control, and then apply breaking mechanics, I need a wedge or wedges, a fulcrum to break the arm and connection to the end of the lever. So I focus their intention on finding, pin, isolate and control an arm so you can break it. In order to do that, you need to find wedges, a fulcrum and a connection to the end of the lever. So intention and attention. Am I moving in the right direction?
Yeah, I think so. Attention, calibrating somebody's attention is to understand where their focus needs to be. So you have to be very careful when you're trying to help guide attention. Intention is a little bit, that's just understanding what you need to do. What you said the task constraint. That's absolutely correct. Intention is understanding what you need to do so that your body can self-organize towards that. Now, understanding where to focus your attention in the service of successfully fulfilling that intention. Obviously, we want to try and use external cues as much as humanly possible for that. But I wouldn't be too detailed with focus of attention. So one of the things that I've noticed Greg Souders does is, for example, if he's doing a class where he's working in the leg entanglement, one of the focuses of attention will be just maintain control, maintain attachment to the leg and hip, or just the leg or just the hip or some, whatever the person needs to work on. So maybe they have, they're wrapped up on the guy's leg, but they're not applying enough pressure to the hip or something like that. I think attention will actually, that will slide where you're guiding the attention is a sliding scale or a spectrum based on wherever the individual is. What is going wrong with that person's execution of the task? And then how can you directing their attention help to shore up that weakness? There's not a lot of super detailed help on how to do that because it's one of these things about the constraints-led approach where, when you first look at it, you're like, oh, this is a hands-off approach and I don't have to, what is even the point of a coach? But then you get deeper into it and you realize actually you have to have a very highly skilled coach in order to do it well. And that's where you will calibrate yourself as a coach to understand as you experiment with different focuses of attention, different cues for athletes experiencing various problems of trying to maintain a pin and extend the elbow or, isolate and extend the elbow. You're going to find out what's going to be generally across the population more productive of a focus of attention to cue your students on. And you start there as a starting point across different, when new people show up. And if it doesn't work, then you try something else. You try a different cue, try a different, and focus. I don't know what to call it. Instruction of some sort. I think you're accurate there and you're headed in the right direction. I just have to caution that when you get to the attentional focus part of that, that you're not too specific because then you have too much information. It becomes almost like a step one, step two, step three type of thing.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
I'll keep working on that.
Cool. Awesome. What about your kickboxing class? How's that come along? How's that shaping up with ecological approach?
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode.